Thanks for listening to another Moment That Matters podcast from Belmont University's Institute for Innovative Faith-Based Leadership, based here in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm Dr. John Roebuck, Executive Director of the Institute. It's my joy to host these weekly podcasts. Podcasts are being recorded at the Malloy Studios, part of the Mike Curb College of Entertainment and Music Business, here on the campus of Belmont University. Today, I'm honored to have in the studio with me Dr. George Mason, Senior Pastor of the Wilshire Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas. George has been pastor at Wilshire for the past 27 years. He is a nationally recognized leader among Baptists. In fact, if you ask anyone in moderate Baptist life about George, they will consistently tell you that he's one of the key voices for authentic and genuine faith expression in the local church. George is a graduate of the University of Miami, and he holds the MDiv and PhD degree from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Fort Worth, Texas. So today I want to spend a few minutes interviewing George. We're going to discuss the intersection of church and culture. And so we welcome George Mason to Belmont, and I want to thank him for being a part of our conversation. George, we're glad you're here.
Thank you, John. It's wonderful to be with you. Looking forward to it.
I hope your stay in Nashville has been good and your visit with Belmont has been productive.
So far, it's just beautiful. I've really enjoyed myself.
One of the things that we're looking at in terms of our work here at the Institute is trying to really figure out the way that culture and church intersect, and how can we as faith leaders lean into those important conversations and somehow make a difference through what we do through ministry. So I just have several questions I wanted to ask your thoughts about. And the first one has to do with cultural influences. There obviously are a number of them that would seek to diminish the role and the effectiveness of the local church. But I'm interested, from your point of view, what do you see as being some of those hot topics, some of those real dangerous sort of conversations that are swirling out there?
Well, I would say that the two that come most to mind immediately are race relations and LGBT concerns. I think what we have is we've reached a tipping point in both of those areas of social concern that are not just social, but they're personal, they are religious, and they're political, and I think it's impossible for us to separate faith life and those areas of human concern today. The church can't any longer retreat to a safe enclave and say that we're going to let things just play out in the culture on these matters. We have a generation of people that I think actually rightly are pushing the church to recognize that either all things are spiritual or they're not. And if we're going to circumscribe certain areas and say, well, that's political or that's economic or that's business or social, then they're going to say, we're not interested.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think we have probably gone beyond the point of no return. And I don't want the church to find itself 10 years from now looking back and saying, you know, we should have said something, we should have done something. So let me kind of follow up on that for a minute. One of the concerns I have is that I'm not sure that churches provide a safe place for those conversations to have within the context of that church. And so tell me maybe what you have done or attempt to do at Wilshire about having political conversations or things around the LGBT conversation that at least lets people talk in a civil, respectful way.
Sure. Well, I think I can talk about both of these two areas. In terms of race relations, we have become part of what's known as the New Baptist Covenant movement, where on a national basis, we are determined to see that Baptists who are predominantly white Baptists and those in predominantly black Baptist churches and are historically separated have ways to come together. Some of those times will be in large convocation kinds of meetings, but in particular at a grassroots level, churches are becoming covenant partners where they are not just saying we want to swap pulpits and have a potluck supper together because that's just too easy and it's just too superficial. But rather they're saying we need to address some social ill in our community that we will work together on to seek justice and to do something that will make us partners and on an equal basis so that we learn to work together and live together and respect one another. And so that's been a very good and challenging way for the congregation to get involved.
So rather
than
look at the model that we all practiced in the 70s and the 80s of the pulpit supply,
right,
the pulpit swap and the choir swap and that kind of thing,
mm-hmm,
you guys are looking for community projects that,
right,
that help serve the greater good, but things that you can do actually hand in hand together where,
yes,
there's relationship building and that sort of thing. So what about the LGBT conversation?
Well, this is pertinent to where we are right now as a church. We are actually going to vote in a few weeks on the question of whether, not whether LGBT Christians are welcome at the church, but whether they share full privileges and responsibilities of membership, which would include the opportunity for them to be ordained and to serve in every leadership role, and including being married in the church.
Sure.
So this is a highly controversial thing in our church. It's the most challenging thing I've ever done as a pastor in making a significant shift in our understanding of something like this. And remember, John, you and I are both old enough to know, you know, how difficult it was to navigate the Baptist wars through the years.
Absolutely.
And the differences there. And then also there were the worship wars and the different kinds of music that you had. And then we proceeded to, you know, ordain women, many of our churches, and that was a challenging thing. Nothing is quite as difficult as this particular one because, well, I say because I don't think anyone fully knows why that is, but clearly spirituality and sexuality are somehow very deeply connected in terms of the intimacy of relationship with God and another human being. So we have been engaged in that process. It's been a year-long study. There have been roundtable conversations in our church. There have been informational studies. There have been recommended readings and Sunday school classes that have taught and all those sorts of things. And the truth of the matter is we will get through it, but we will lose significant number of people.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. However that vote goes, you're in danger of losing people on either side of that argument, I would say.
We already have lost people because some think it's unfaithful to even have the conversation.
Gotcha.
They're really clear that all same-sex behavior is sin by definition, and the church either has to say so or else it's unfaithful.
Right.
Others are more generous than that on the subject, but they say something to the effect of it's no greater sin than any other sin, and therefore, or they say something like everyone is welcome here, including gay Christians, and we understand that someone doesn't make a choice to be gay, but the choice that they are able to make is whether to act upon that in terms of their relationships. So, others are saying, look, we have a new civil rights issue here that is in the church, and it's not just civil rights. It's now the question of, are there not just second-class citizens in the kingdom of God, but are there favored children and unfavored children?
Yeah.
Are you saying that we love everyone, but some people have to be more limited in their participation in the church? And if you ever say, we love you, but you may think that you're completely loving, but the people on the other side of that only hear what's on the other
side
of
but. They hear that differently. That's right.
That's right. So this is a really challenging thing for us. I believe that we will vote to have full inclusion and full participation without limitations. Limitations that aren't true for everyone. You know,
right.
It's not special. It's equal.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're right, John. We are going through a painful process of losing people who have been part of the church for a long time and who simply think this is a bridge too far for them.
Well, I just want to applaud your courage in at least having those conversations. It's such a nuanced conversation to even endeavor to undertake. and the fact that you have vetted that over a year and have allowed people the opportunity to have input, I think, is going to be an important part of that conversation. Again, today our guest is Dr. George Mason, pastor of Wilshire Baptist Church. George, as you know, we are living in the midst of a horrible political season.
Yes.
The political divide in our nation is wide and deep. And so a question I have is, in terms of this election, it's going to end, mercifully, I hope, in about 3 weeks. We know much of the political wrangling and conversation won't end in 3 weeks.
Right.
But I'm curious how you would think in terms of how do we begin to bridge the divide that is so divisive and really has spilled over into a lot of the evangelical world in particular? How do we begin to look at each other again, knowing that we were so divided on the question of politics, but we're somehow supposed to walk together in unity?
Right. So I think some of our experience in the LGBT conversation has been instructive to me in this, in that what I've said to people is, look, we're going to someday be on the other side of this decision and this vote. Then the question is, what will the experience of how we've gone through it teach us about how we're going to live together afterward? And the harder we make it on each other during this process, the more difficult it is for us to be one church again. So there are certain things that you have to do in the course of the process, and that is not be willing to win a battle and lose the war.
Yeah.
You can't, I mean, part of the problem with our election process is both Democrats and Republicans think if they can just win the White House, then they're in charge at least for 4 years, but they don't think about the fact that there will be deep divisions in the country and between the parties that they're not going to be able to govern. They're not going to be able to do what's good for the whole country. They've succeeded in achieving a short-term goal, and they've sacrificed a long-term sense of peoplehood,
yeah,
of one people. So one of the things I've said to people is, look, nobody wants to be characterized by their worst moments, by their worst statements,
sure,
by their most careless deeds. If we always attack someone at their weakest place, we dishonor them in a way that is not true to their full heart and the true narrative of their whole life. And so if we don't want to be treated that way ourselves, then we can't treat one another that way. We can't sacrifice that long-term relationship for that short-term win.
I remember, as you would, you know, earlier days, I remember Carter-Reagan debates and others, when there was such a civility and respect, even in those dialogues, it was always my distinguished opponent said this or that. And,
yes,
and I think there are a number of us who lived through those days who are grieved by the level of anger and rancor that has displayed itself. And I think the role of social media plays a lot about that.
Right.
I mean, would you speak to that for a minute in terms of,
yes,
our ability now to say whatever we want to say whenever we want to say it and have it broadcast to thousands of people is not a safe tool for all of us to have in our hands?
No, I think actually you've already said it in your question, but I think the thing you can add to that is that there is little personal, emotional, or social consequence to you,
yeah,
when you get on social media to do that, because people are nameless or faceless out there and they're reading it, you don't really have to deal with them personally, and it might be a good guiding principle for us that before we ever hit send on a tweet or a Facebook post or anything like that, we think to ourselves, if that person reading it were standing right across from me or sitting across, yeah, the table from me, am I willing to own this thought?
Yeah, would I say that?
Would I say that to their face?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's change directions for just a minute. Again, our guest is Dr. George Mason. One of the groups that is starting to bubble up, at least in religious conversations across the nation, are these people we are calling the Dunns,
mm-hmm,
people who claim they are done with organized religion, but they are certainly not done with their faith. A lot of research is being done about that group. But I guess my question for you is, why do you think people feel a disillusionment with the church to the point they're willing just to pull out and say, I'm going to find faith and religious expression somewhere else? And is there something we can do as the body of Christ to somehow find a way to incorporate them back into the life and work of the church?
Well, as you say, I think they're not necessarily all characterized by one demographic or one experience. Some of them, of course, are people who have grown up in the church and they have reached a point where they are deeply disillusioned with the institutional church and they've made that decision. And they've done so because they've actually known what the church is about and they have done something about it to reject it. I think the other part of that story is that there are those who are done with it who have never really had a great acquaintance with it. They're done with something that they have perceived to be true, mm-hmm. but we have a generation of people that has grown up without being enfranchised to such an extent that they would be disenfranchised. So there's more than one group, but I think there are certain common things involved in that, and that is they want to see trustworthiness and authenticity. They don't want to see the same kind of political machinations going on sure. in the church that they see in their workplace or in their university setting or in the political sphere. They want to believe there is an alternative model out there. And at our best, the church has always provided an alternative community, a way of functioning that says there's another way to live together. And here it is, where we respect one another, where every voice is heard and none is privileged, that people can sacrifice and care for each other and not only look out for their own interests. When they see that not happening, it loses its allure because it has nothing to offer. When they see people competing with one another and rejecting each other because they have failed, well, what's the difference between that and your quarterly review? You didn't make it, so you're out. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to believe that there is an alternative way of living in the world. And historically, the gospel community, the church, represented that. When it doesn't, it's our own fault. Yeah. And I don't think we need to point the finger at them for giving up on us.
Dr. Josh Packard, who's going to be on campus next week, has done some writing in a book he's entitled The Church Refugees. He says that one of the factors about the Dunns that is so critically important to them is that sense of community,
right.
that they look for community in the church, and when they don't find community, they go somewhere else to where they mm-hmm. might be able to capture that. And I think he's probably right. Mm-hmm. I was talking to a group of millennials last night and asked them what it was about community that was so important. And the words that you've used, authenticity, honesty, people who accept me where I am, people who will grow with me, people I can ask questions of and find answers. Mm-hmm. So what would you say is so vitally important in terms of the body of Christ that brings us a sense of community?
Yes. Well, I think the thing that people of our generation don't understand is that younger people, millennials and the like, are they're not seeking community. They are already in community. They practice it all the time. They have their smartphones with them everywhere they go, and they are connected. They have multiple communities. They feel like their lives are already always networked with other people. Now, the tendency of our generation is to think, no, you're not really having face-to-face conversations all the time. You're really not in committed relationships. And we think you ought to learn these things about community. Actually, we might learn some things about community from them, too. Mm. They might teach us some things about how we can't escape from our relationship with other people. Everywhere we go, we carry people around with us just the way they do. And then they may learn some things from us also about the endurance of relationships through difficult times, the need for face-to-face conversation, those sorts of things. And I do think the church can help with that as we are in communion with one another.
And communion is a good word, that sense of common unity with one another. Mm-hmm. Again, our guest today has been Dr. George Mason. And George, as we get ready to sign off, I know you've been at Wilshire 27 years, been a great long ministry for you, and just curious about what the future holds for you. You're turning 60 right now, and plan to stay a while. What's the plan?
I think so. I don't know that it's going to be another 10 years, but I can see the finish line of this phase of ministry. I think you have to almost think of it as chapters in a book, right? I don't think as pastors we have a sense of vocation that isn't so much a job that you retire from, but maybe a different chapter that you write about location, mode of ministry, and you've done that in your transition, and you're still a minister, you're still a pastor, and you're doing it in a different way. At the moment, I think I've got a few more years with this congregation, and I'd like to see them into a transition to my successor, but I've enjoyed it very much.
Well, we hope you're around for a long time. George has been of enormous value to the kingdom and to people that we call Baptists, and I appreciate your leadership through the years, and we're grateful you've been with us here on the campus of Belmont today, and we hope that your time in Nashville has been productive, and we just offer you our blessings, our prayerful support as you go. Thanks, George.
Thank you so much, John, and all the work that you're doing as well.
Thank you so much.